Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the Enlightenment Evolution Network. Welcome to Earth Sky People Radio. Living in harmony with Mother Earth and awakening to an intergalactic society. With your host, Victoria Vives, founder of Reiki Wellbeing and co-founder of the Earth Sky People Movement. Any opinions expressed in Earth Sky People Radio do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Enlightenment Evolution Network. Any opinions expressed by Earth Sky People Radio's guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Earth Sky People Radio.
Hello, this is Victoria Vives-Cohn with Earth Sky People Radio and Earth Sky People TV. Today we have here with us U.S. Marine Captain Randy Kramer, also known as Captain K. He is a whistleblower claiming having served 17 years as a member of the U.S. Defense Force on Mars. He has 20 years of experience in a very hands-on military career and has been given the direct authority through his chain of command to share his knowledge with the public and civilian government. And his website is earthcitizenconsulting.org. Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Victoria?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to have you here. And I know that you are going through a lot of stuff. You were sharing that it's a crazy time, right?
Yeah, lots of interesting, crazy stuff going on, that's for sure.
Can you share something?
Well, it's pretty much a clear violation of protocols to discuss open investigations. And probably the biggest thing that's on my plate at the moment are some investigations that I'm getting to head up. So that's really the most interesting thing and is taking up the most time and my energy. And some ways I really wish I could talk about them because it's incredibly interesting work. But at the moment, because we're in the middle of investigations, I can't really talk about them. So all I can really say is that people who have been following, you know, along, there will be some very interesting things to update probably next year when some of these investigations get concluded and we have some results to sort of talk about, and it'll could be some pretty interesting stuff. And I'm understating there, it could be really interesting, so I just can't really say much more about that. The other things I can suppose I can talk about is I got to teach this psionics workshop a couple of times, do a little teeny sort of bit in July, and it went well enough that we decided to try and do a whole weekend of it, which went again so well that we really realized that it wasn't enough time to sort of go front to back on what I wanted to do. So we kind of did 2.5 days, and really next time, if I'm going to do it right, it's going to be need to be like 4 days. So, and that was just because of realizing that in order to convey the entire block of information that I really felt was important front to back without leaving people like, sorry, we didn't cover half the important things. Good luck. I mean, I don't feel like that's a responsible, me being a responsible teacher by doing that. So after this was just an experiment really to see like how much time does it take? What can I sort of teach in 2.5 days? And so it went really well. I think it was a roaring success and everyone who attended had a fantastic time and has given great feedback. So it went really well in that sense. It was just still an experiment of, can I cram everything into 2.5 days? And the answer was no, I can't cram everything into 2.5 days. So some stuff got left off the table. And so next time we'll just have to make sure that we do, you know, like a solid 4 days or something to really get it all in. But it was really fun and really dynamic and we had a great time. And, I mean, I could go on about it, but we did record the entire thing, and we're supposed to be producing a DVD of it, so there can be sort of a thing that we're going to have that people will be able to watch the presentation and sort of, you know, more importantly than me wanting to teach a bazillion classes on psionics is like getting the information out there so people can just sort of absorb it and deal with it. And I don't want to have to be responsible for teaching everybody about this all the time, so we're trying to come up with a solid, you know, DVD presentation of the subject that you know, people can sort of refer to, and it's complete enough that, you know, you're not necessarily going to have, you know, Albert Einstein explain it to you, because it's just not that kind of rocket surgery kind of stuff. It's much more fundamental and simple for people to understand. And as I also explained during the workshop, really what I'm trying to do is teach what, on another world where people accepted that they had psionic abilities from day one, you'd learn this when you were a toddler. You know, this isn't something you'd be coming to in an adult life. If you lived on another world where you just accepted that you had psionic abilities, you would. This is all very fundamental stuff, kindergarten level stuff that you would have learned as a toddler and would just be second nature by the time you were an adolescent. So, yeah, I'm in no way trying to teach like advanced psionic abilities or the laws of psionics. I'm really just teaching the fundamental basics so that people can understand how it works, get their left and their right brains talking to each other on it so they can have whole-minded, balanced brainwave experiences. And then we talk about how that becomes the ultimate sort of first step goal is brainwave mastery, because then once you start to understand brainwave mastery is how all of your actually maximized mental and psionic abilities start to manifest, is when you can actually harmonize your brainwaves. And that's not some vague thing. We understand very specifically about how you have to harmonize those brainwaves and what kind of patterns you want your brainwaves to make when you're doing that, how you want these sort of balanced, whole-minded or awakened mind sort of patterns that we call them. So it was fun, but it's just basic, and I feel like that still takes a few days to really get all that information in there, and we got almost all of it, but, you know, another couple of day and a half to really be complete next time. But it was fabulous. We had a good time.
So when are you coming to Los Angeles to teach that?
Well, I'm not sure where we're going to do the next one or exactly how it's going to happen. Of course, I've been invited to go back up to East City again, up in Washington again, which I'm happy to do. Part of my instinct, though, is possibly picking another geographical location on the West Coast that's not too far away from me, to give a little bit of another opportunity for some other people to show up. I know that, you know, distance of traveling can make a difference, and we certainly got more people who were close to us. Not that people didn't come from across the country, some people did, but we certainly got more people who were close, and if I came down south farther. And so I've got people who I know in Shasta. We've been thinking about something in Shasta. That would be nice. I have a friend who just went through a big move and who is between Los Angeles and San Diego and got like I want to say it was 12, 14 acres or something. And they've been seriously talking about, you know, putting in a little conference center. Like they've been trying to tell me, no, it's perfect. It'll work. It'll be great. Perfect conference. And I'm like, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm presuming that this person is very excited about that, not just because it's a vague dream, but because they do a lot of public speaking and presentation and are very excited about having a place on their property where they can do presentations and do seminars. So we'll see how that goes. I'm kind of just trying to deal with one thing at a time. And so I'm absolutely want to think about where and when that's going to be next, but kind of what's on my plate as far as man hours are these investigations at the moment. I had colleagues fly out from across the country to sort of work on it this week. And so we actually were up to our eyeballs in weird cray cray. And it's been taking a lot of mental, emotional, and physical energy to do that. And so I haven't been able to plan another workshop while I'm sort of got my nose deep into this investigation at the moment. But that's a good question. When will I be coming closer to you? And the answer is I'm not sure, but we're thinking about it was enough of an experiment that went well enough that I'm thinking about how the next one will be closer to perfect that I want, you know, if it's the right amount of days and everything that I want it to be. So I don't know yet. I'm working on it.
Okay, that's fine. That's great. The DVD is on the way, so I'm going to get there. Okay. So I would like for you to share about the project Moon Shadow in case any of our listeners and viewers are not familiar with it.
Oh, sure. Project Moon Shadow was a project that I was brought into when I was a child. It was a 300-subject program, meaning there were 300 children who were brought into the program, and it was a United States Marine Corps Special Section augmented soldier, super soldier training program, which was designed to create super soldiers that were not, you know, like beaten like fighting dogs in order to make them tough, which is sort of the old school murder, what we call sort of the old school murder machine way of training super soldiers, which is, you know, kind of the same way that you train a fighting dog, which is kind of beat it hard until you make it so mean and angry, you know, that it will just snarl and want to bite anything, which is very old, you know, school kind of Nazi trauma-based mind control kind of way of doing things. And so in the mid-60s, United States Marine Corps commissioned a study on these augmented soldier programs because we kind of felt that the fundamental way of breaking someone in order to build them didn't really seem like that was the way you wanted to do it, that maybe what you really wanted to do was build something correctly from the ground up instead of taking something that you felt you had to break and smash in order to try and restructure. And, you know, we kind of felt that that was a lot like trying to, like, make a great vase by taking an already made one and smashing it and then gluing it back together. That didn't seem like a very good idea. Maybe you should really, from the beginning of the process, and especially when you understand how human beings develop, brain development and mind-body development and neural pathway development is so much more fundamental in the 0 to 3, 3 to 5 age range. I mean, at this childhood range, that if you really want to create a fundamentally better human being, no matter what you want them to do, and this is why I'm a major proponent of early childhood and Head Start, you know, kind of education, because we know that when you get children started on their developmental skills when they're very, very, very young is when they connect their brain neural pathways and they get connected and they get more engaged with their universe and more better problem solvers. And they're just, you make smarter kids by teaching them how to sort of interact with their universe and their reality when they're very, very young. Really, if you're waiting till they're 5 or 6 years old, you waited too long. You know, it's fundamental to educate kids, you know, all the way through. But if you're waiting until they're 5 or 6, you've waited too long. You know, you really have to start when they're very, very young. So if you want to create a powerful psionic soldier or a powerful super soldier, the question really isn't how you break something and rebuild it. It's how do you start from the ground up? Mm-hmm. And we also felt that that was more ethical, because you're taking someone and then breaking them in order to sort of mold them in what you want. And it seemed actually more ethical to engineer and design someone to be the thing that you would want them to be, because then they're going to be following their own grain of genetic distinction and they're going to want to do that thing. So we wanted to make soldiers that actually wanted to defend their people and wanted to defend their planet and would sort of be willing to fight and do the right thing and not just kill on command. And that was really against the grain of what everyone else was doing. So anyway, we commissioned this study that said, we think it's a waste of time and a huge waste of money to be breaking people and then trying to rebuild them, because the actual amount of days, months, years, hours, battle hours that you get from one of those soldiers is minimal compared to what you should be able to get from an effective, balanced, structurally sound human being. So we felt that it was a waste of money, a waste of time, and that you were not getting the most effective use of material just because you were able to get someone to kill on command at the snap of a finger. Doesn't mean that they're doing all their other jobs with any other sort of clarity or precision. And you need soldiers to be thinking machines, not just killing machines, because they actually have to do a lot of thinking on the ground and thinking with what's happening right in front of them in order to do their job properly, hit the right target, not hit the wrong target, not do the wrong thing. I mean, you can't just rely on attack dogs to do your job. You have to have smart thinking, tactically aware attack dogs to do your job for you. And so, you know, we really just felt like it had to be a different way. So the program that I was designed under was designed to build people from the ground up, to genetically engineer them in petri dishes and start from the very, very ground up of their genetic engineering, and then put them into a training program that, instead of beating them like fighting dogs, would actually train them to cooperate, work together, problem solve, and actively pursue goal-oriented missions, so that by the time you're in adolescent training and you're using actual tools and weapons and so forth, you know, all of this other sort of rudimentary tactical and teamwork training's already been ingrained when you were 5. On top of all this genetic engineering that takes away all these other elements that, you know, you have to weed out when you're just picking people in a volunteer or even in a draft sort of military where you're just pooling a bunch of different people together and going, well, let's see who sucks and who doesn't, you know, in this. And you sometimes you just end up finding people that are just no good for military life. And you just go, nah, this one's a wash. You call him a washout. Now that one's a washout. It's not, he's not going to, he or she is not going to work in this system. But when you engineer someone from the ground up, And I want to preclude that you're not just engineering someone to be obedient. You really don't just want obedient slaves when you do this. You want to engineer them to be smart because you want them not just to carry out your orders. You want them to comprehend your orders and do the best job of following, you know, those parameters and not just, well, you told me to get the thingy, you know, instead of like, well, yeah, but without, you know, collateral damage and without breaking that and without destroying that building, that was kind of important. You know, you forgot about the data chip. That was really important. I mean, there's just all kinds of criteria that if you're dumb, you're not going to think about. You can screw up a mission. So as a military leader, you want soldiers that are smart and effective. So we came up with this whole other program, and that's sort of how I was designed and engineered from the ground up. I was made in a Petri dish. So while some people have to ponder their lives about who made me, what am I here for, where did I come from, like, I know that there's somewhere a group of guys in lab coats that are responsible for my creation, and, you know, that's, in some ways that simplifies my reality for me because it at least answers the question. I don't have to worry about who am I or where I came from because I know. I'm a lab experiment.
That would be your physical body, maybe your mind, but what about your soul? I imagine your soul is coming from a further place beyond all of this.
That's a much more complicated subject. And certainly there's a whole sort of more complicated metaphysical side to not just genetically engineering, you know, the soldiers from the end of the project, but how the soul science operates. And so how you sort of negotiate and or dictate and or encourage certain souls to take root or habitation within that cellular cluster and be part of that person. And that's a little complicated and esoteric for me to talk about in the sense it's not my specialty to talk about it, so I might not use the best words to explain it, but there absolutely is a more complicated relationship with the soul that I'm well aware of who and what that is and where that comes from and how far back that goes. I have a pretty solid awareness of my soul, but it's not something that I talk too much about, and I don't consider that it's too important fundamentally for mostly what I do for most people to talk for me to talk about that. But yeah, there's absolutely a relationship that's much more complicated in not just creating a better genetically engineered soldier, but also understanding from the soul science perspective that if you make a better foundation, you know, I got to go back to Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come, right? There is something to be said there. If you build that fundamental genetic structure right, the right soul that can live in that genetic structure will arrive. You know, like if you build it, it will come. So there's something about creating a better genetic example that then a higher quality, higher energy soul can come into that, because genetics and physiology limit the amount of input and power that a soul can come into. It's why we can't just immediately heal ourselves and, you know, levitate our bodies into the sky, because we have to go through this process of physical limitation. It being an unlimited energy source in a physically limited, you know, body that has limits. You can only walk up a mountain so far before you get tired, thirsty, hungry, you know, your muscles give out, or maybe you're strong enough and you can get all the way up. But most people are going to find their limits when they do something like climbing a mountain or lifting giant boulders or push your car down the road for a couple of miles. And you're going to learn a thing or two about your physical limitations, because you're going to find out at what point your body's going to go like, I can't do this anymore. And so as unlimited as our soul energy is, we do experience life through this limited energy. So when you create a more powerfully potentialized cellular cluster a genetic arrangement that does enable sort of this more powerful, energetically enabled soul to come into it. So the whole plan was to do something that was very holistic, not just, you know, biological in a petri dish, but.
Right. And there is this technology that can get your cells into a container, I guess, and then put it in another body. And this is something that happened to you, right? Several times. I don't know how many.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how many times because I'm not conscious most of the time when that happens. Most of the time after that happens is because my body's been blown apart enough times that, you know, they have to move something from one vessel to the other. You're kind of, you're not conscious sort of physically for that. You're kind of on your tether and you're in between worlds when that happens. So you're not really aware of what's happening with your body. You just kind of end up coming back to it when it's all ready. But yeah, there's definitely a science to that. Your soul is a quantum fluid dynamic. So it's made up of a quantum light fluid. So it does have the ability to be pulled out, siphoned out, sucked out, you know, and contained in something. But it is a technology that's beyond what most of us as civilians understand the laws of physics to operate. But it's something that, you know, ETs have been aware of for a while and that they brought to us decades ago. So we've been cracking soul science for quite a while. And it's not new. It's not new. You know, soul science is kind of old. And so we've had this technology for a while. I would say that we really started to mass introduce it as something that we used on a daily regular basis in the covert space program in the mid 70s. So really, yeah, I mean, it was really something that we were using like on a daily basis in the mid 70s.
Amazing. And for example, I don't know if you agree with this idea that there is an earth covering the earth. So any soul that, you know, somebody passes away and the soul tries to go free and it is reincarnated, would this be the same technology that is being used for this purpose?
That's an interesting, subtle point. Let me see if I can answer that. The natural process for, you know, your souls to pass sort of into non-physicality and back to physicality is a natural process. And there is also a more natural process of coming and going as far as, you know, our ability to say, I'm done on this world. I'm out of here. I'm going somewhere else. And for other people in other worlds to go, hey, I want to be incarnated there and to come here. So the net, the artificial net, it limits that. And what it causes is a certain number of people who are headed out to just bounce right back. And it causes a certain number of people who are headed in to bounce right back off and return off the net. But it's not 100% in the sense that everything that hits it stops and bounces back. It's a net. It's possible to wiggle through one of the holes and get through it. But, you know, you have to be a smarter fish than that. You know what I'm saying? Like if there are fish that get caught in a net because they're not smart enough to figure out how to find the hole to get out. But, you know, if they're actually aware enough of the net and whatever, then maneuvering through it is not rocket surgery. It's just a matter of awareness of it being there and how to find your way through it. So when you're talking about people developing their consciousness to a point of having solid sort of spiritual, meditative, metaphysical skills, one of the things you're talking about is someone to have a clear sense of their self and their direction, either in a lucid dream state, in an out-of-body experience, or in a post-physical death experience. So instead of just floating around going, woo, it's all colors, you actually are like, oh, wait, I'm not in a body anymore. I want to go this direction. It takes a whole other kind of focus in that reality to actually go, wait a minute, I got to think about this. I want to go somewhere. I want to do this instead of just floating around going, look at the colors. Because otherwise being non-physical, you're just kind of surrounded by energetic sensations and colors and sounds that aren't here. So all those fourth dimensional colors are shiny and sparkly and interesting and make you go, woo. So it's easy to become distracted. It's easy when you sort of move to that fourth dimensional state to be so distracted by the, oh, wow, it's so shiny and sparkly and just be distracted and lost in whatever you thought you were thinking about 5 minutes before.
And what is your view on implants? You know, I know that many people in my circle feel that they have an implant. I have felt that as well. And I know that you spoke about how to reprogram them if they are negative, but do you also believe that some of them may actually be positive?
An implant, by its very definition, is a piece of technology that has been put into somebody's body, okay? So it's not a living thing. It's a machine. It's a little tiny, 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 tiny little machine. And even if it's as advanced, you know, of a tiny, tiny computer more than your iPhone, you know, let's just put a comparison to it, it's still just a machine. And so a machine that's in you has no thought process of its own, has no consciousness of its own, has no will of its own, has no morality of its own, has no ethics of its own, has no judgment of its own. It just has hardware and software. So the hardware is designed to do certain things as far as send signals, receive signals, and or send inputs into the electrical system, the central nervous system, or wherever it's designed to stimulate to get your body or your brain to feel, do, or experience something. And the software that drives it, you know, all the apps that tell it what to do and how to do it and exactly how to make that function work. So implants, by their very function, are neutral tools that somebody put in there for a purpose. Now, whether that was a good purpose or a bad purpose has everything to do with the person who put it there and the group of people that they operate with or work for and what their overall agenda is and who manufactured those and what the goal of manufacturing and putting those in people are. So there's a whole – if we were to do something like that, right, we would have to set up a program with a director and put people under them to figure out how to make this device and how to make it work and then how we were going to implant it and how we're going to program it. Extraterrestrials got to do the same thing, right? They don't just have magical powers either to just go, boing, I made this because I thought it up. And without processing it, testing it, they still have to go through a scientific process. Mm-hmm. And it may be faster and smarter than sometimes what we have to do. But engineering is still the same. You go, well, this is what we got on paper. Now let's make it in the real world and see if that's going to match up. And almost every time, engineering wise, you're going to realize that there's fine tuning in making that engineered thing that's not just on paper actually work and do what you want it to do, because understanding something in theory and principle and being able to make a device that does it are not the same thing. And anybody who's ever designed or built something knows that. So extraterrestrials got to do the same thing. So at some point, those implants were designed, they were manufactured, they were programmed, they had a purpose by someone who decided this is going to have a purpose and this is what I want to do and this is what we're going to put it in people to do that. So given that, the next thing that's most important to understand is an old yoga teacher of mine, when I was having issues realizing that I had implants and I didn't know what to do with them and I was trying to struggle with them and I felt all the kinds of weird things that they were doing inside my body that were felt outside of my control. And I was like, I don't know what to do. This is the heaviest thing that I've ever had to deal with. I've got little machines inside my body that want to tell my body what to do and I don't know what to do with it. And he said, sweet. I mean, I don't think he said sweet. He said, that's great. And I was like, what do you mean that's great? That's not cool at all. And he said, no. He said, the people who put those in you fail to understand a universal law. And that universal law is, if it's in your body, it belongs to you. He said, so by putting that in your body, they gave that to you. That's a gift now that they gave you. And they may have put it in your body to do something for them, but they gave that to you. It's yours. So you can decide to do what you want with it. You can reprogram them. You can keep them. You can burn them out. You can fry them. You can melt them. Or you can figure out how they work and use them for your own purposes. And so I spent about 6 months like in a daily, twice daily morning and night meditation process of like, you know, taking control of these implants. And for 6 months it was, they're mine. No, they're not. They're mine. No, they're not. They're mine. And it was a struggle. I mean, the people who did not want me taking control of them were like, nope, yes, no, yeah. I mean, it was a back and forth for about 6 months. And then after about 6 months, I finally was like, no, mine. No, really, mine. And I could keep a hold of that. And all of a sudden, we went from struggle, 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 struggle to these are mine, you can't use them anymore, and now I get to decide what they do or what they don't do, and I get to rewrite, you know, their software. And little nanites in my body that are designed to repair things, too, from the inside out. Once I got control over those and started rewriting the software for those, I had two very odd sort of experiences where I got nerve damage, one which was pretty much, I'm sure, from some kind of toxic poisoning that caused a nerve damage above my left eye, and I had this twitch that would not go away, and it was basically I tried to say, like, well, maybe it'll go away on itself, for about 6 months, and it didn't. And I finally went to go see my doctor, and he's like, well, if it's nerve damage, I don't know, we might be able to find some meds to give you to do it, but you might have a twitch for the rest of your life. And I was not cool with that. And then it just kind of dawned on me in a moment of clarity. Oh yeah, I have these little machines inside my body that might be able to fix that. And so I issued an instruction to fix the nerve damage above my left eye. And the next day, it really stopped twitching. And by the second day, it didn't ever twitch again, ever. No. And then when I was still running, like jogging every day when I still could, when I had good knees and ankles that could do that, when I had young men's ankles and knees that could still do that, I made the mistake of running a kind of a pair of shoes into the ground so that the padding really was just like almost non-existent. I just pounded the crap out of these shoes. So I went for a really hard run one day, and I was taking these really hard steps, and I came home, and the bottoms of my feet were tingly. I basically nerve damaged the bottoms of my feet, pounding them into the ground. And that took about 30 days because there's more nerve endings on the bottoms of your feet than one little thing up in your eye. So it took longer, but, you know, you're not supposed to just fix nerve damage. And I did twice with the little nano robots that are in my body. So to me, that's enough proof positive that you can take control of them. You can use them and make them whatever you want. So I know a lot of people are really into removing implants, getting rid of them. They're all bad. Get rid of them. Get rid of them. I'm just like, well, maybe you want to keep them. Maybe you want to make them work for you. Maybe you want to rewrite the software. Maybe you want to use it instead of just, you know, toss it out. So I think it's a process that people have to go through and figure out and decide, you know, whether they want to go through the trouble of taking control of them or go through the trouble of getting rid of them. Either way can be a process, and either way can be something that doesn't end in one day. You know, the next day you may have them removed, and the next night they brought them back again going, oh, well, so much for that. We'll just put another round of them in you. So it can be a battle either way, you know, like trying to get them removed and or trying to take control of them can be a process where you want your freedom and someone doesn't want you to be free. And so you're going to have a struggle with that.
I certainly agree with, you know, taking control of it. I actually did a little bit of that process, similar to what you were sharing. I just didn't do it so consciously as you are doing it. So I totally agree with that. And I wanted to ask you, how can somebody know if they have been in any of these projects, like the one that you have been in, the Moonshadow project?
The process of regaining repressed memory is that repressed memory wants to get out. So most people who have repressed memories don't have to spend a bunch of time trying to get into those memories at first. They're going to be trying to get out. Most people are going to come into the struggle in their lives of, I thought I was totally normal yesterday, and now today I'm not so sure. And, you know, you start to have these, you're left with these emotional responses from the experiences. So even if you can't remember the linear experience, most people have, you know, some kind of physical, neurological, central nervous system, emotional post-traumatic stress disorder from the experience. Even in such cases as myself, where the training program wasn't designed to traumatize me, enough years of combat is traumatizing, and you see enough crazy instances, and you see enough people get blown up, and you have enough body parts ripped, you know, from you limb from limb, and it gets traumatic. But not everyone is a battle hardened soldier. Some people, you know, sort of remote viewers, psionic spies. We have psionic specialists. I mean, there's a classification of people who are physical soldiers, and then a lot of people who do a lot of, you know, psionic meta kind of work. And that can be less traumatic, but it can also be very traumatic, because sometimes the things that they have remote viewers look at are pretty horrifying. I know some remote viewers who have had to look at some things that were not pleasant to look at, you know, and so, you know, they sort of had their own horrific experiences, having to sort of gaze and report on some pretty horrific things sometimes. So the main thing is, if you're experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety and, you know, certain kinds of, you know, insomnia and visitation experiences that you can't really put your fingers on, and it all seems very sort of shady and shifty, you know, you're going to know from your own visceral sort of physiological responses that there's something that you have to get to the bottom of. And then, but they're your memories. No one has to tell you what your memories are. You don't have to go to a specialist to, like, get your memories. You don't have to go to someone to get, you know, hypnotized to get your memories. You know, they're your memories. You have the right to them, and you pretty much can tell your body and your brain that you want them and that you want to remember and that, you know, you want this process to happen. But it's a very gradual process, in the sense that I can say this for sure. If the moment that I realized, and there was a moment when I realized, hey, there's something buried under here, like really buried, like there's a whole part of me that's under here and I can feel it, but it's, I'm not sure exactly what's going on. There's like a moment when you're back and forth, well, is it really? And then you're like, oh yeah, there is, but you don't really know what's going on. That moment, if you got all your memories in that moment, you die. Okay, I mean, the overwhelming emotional physiological impact of all of that at once, if you didn't just, you know, curl up into a ball and start twitching and have an aneurysm and die, you might just go, oh, well, that makes sense, and then go into the back and blow your head off, because the stress of going from night to day in that kind of a way is way too much. So there had to be a gradual process where, you know, if I didn't digest it in bites, there's no way I could have done it. So I would also suggest to anyone, look, you're talking about an experience that wasn't 6 months, wasn't 5 years. You're talking about something that stretched out across a lifetime of childhood training, adolescent training, and then in most cases, covert military space program personnel do a 20-year tour that you're brought back from, have your memories repressed. They, you know, we call it age reversing, but they really just put you into a younger, they basically hatch out a younger clone version of you that was the age that you were when you left, and then put you back into that body, reinsert you into your timeline, and go, forget, and then basically anticipate that you're just going to live your life like nothing happened, which of course is absolutely impossible after that happens. You don't just get to go back and reinsert it into your timeline and live your life like, oh, nothing happened. No, not at all. You're going back into your timeline with no linear memory of what just happened, but of all the psychological and emotional trauma and physiological, neurological trauma of the entire experience, not to mention you're years older, you're years more experienced as a person. It makes feeling your age weird. It makes socializing with your peers weird. It makes relationships weird, because all of a sudden you may think you're 19 years old trying to have a relationship with another 19-year-old, but the truth is you're 39 trying to have a relationship with a teenager. And so you realize that mentally and emotionally you're really not the same, and you're not where other people are around you, and it's difficult to socialize, it's difficult to make relationships, it's difficult to understand yourself. And so you're going through this whole process that's not normal at all. That's not, you know, you're fine. No, not at all. You've completely discombobulated someone's life and told them, figure it out. And I will tell people, look, it was a 20-year tour of duty and a 20-year healing process when I got back from that tour of duty to sort it out. So the main thing that I would tell anyone who's trying to sort that process out, be very, very patient with yourself, because it's going to take years. Yeah. Even nowadays, when people are going through the process faster sometimes, don't rush it. Expect it to take a while, because if you rush it, you're really just going to, you know, hurt yourself in a way that I wouldn't recommend that anybody hurt themselves by rushing through, you know, I want to know right now, I want to know right now, I want to know right now. No, no, no. Take it a dose at a time and you'll get there. Yeah. Don't rush it. You'll blow a gasket.
You know, and I have some of those memories. The thing is, I'm not sure if it is from this lifetime or another, but I had some of those, like, it was so, it made such an impact on me that I really didn't want to look into it. So if something has to come to my mind more consciously, I guess it will come with time.
Yeah, that's the part of you that's going, I'm not so sure I'm ready for that, you know, because it really is, it's just a lot more shocking to your system than we kind of think that it is. And I'll make another comparison. I think a lot of people who talk about wanting to meet with, you know, our ET's brothers and sisters, they're like, well, I just wish an ET would knock on my door and come to my house. I was like, yeah, you say that. But, you know, the instant that you're face-to-face with an extraterrestrial biological entity that's not like you, actually the more likelihood that your physiological response is going to go through is you're going to panic, piss your pants, and scream, and nearly have an anxiety attack before, and it may, before you go through the process of like, oh, wait, okay, no, calm down. Okay, I mean, like, that's the more natural process to go through. Even for trained observers and trained people, you know, the first time that you have that contact experience, even if you've been prepped for it and you're ready for it and you know it's just like a new level of normal, believe me, you know, that first experience is actually so physiologically shocking and anxiety-ridden that there's an adjustment period. And I don't think that should be an excuse for us not to, like, get into disclosure. Like, I don't want people – because I know some people use that as the excuse. Well, people would be so shocked that they couldn't handle it. No, I disagree. There's a shock – but it has to happen and people have to get over it, like all other kinds of shocks. Like, you know, there was a time, you know, when the whole world moved at the speed of horse and if you didn't move and there was nothing that moved faster than a horse. And then all of a sudden there was trains. Oh my goodness. I mean, you know, the giant locomotives, I mean, that freaked people the frick out. The trains like flying across the country and the big locomotives. And then all of a sudden horseless carriages. What is this craziness? I mean, there was a time when such rudimentary things like automobiles were a shock to people that were just like, oh, I went to the city and all them horseless carriages, oh, discombobulated me. I mean, there were literally people freaking out about these technological changes as they were occurring. So it's okay for us to have an adjustment period, right? That this is what it's like now, and that's what it's going to be like then, and there's an adjustment period, and we all have to kind of, like, get over it, take a few deep breaths, and just, like, get over it. I just don't think that saying people are going to be shocked is a reason to not get over it. That's all the more reason to just be like, okay, let's get this out on the table, let everyone get over it, and then we can move on, because I think that's really all that's going to happen is that you're going to have an adjustment period of people going, and then 6 months later, it'll be, we've talked about this enough, it's our new normal, aliens, and that'll be the way it is. So, again, just my advice for people working out that process, be patient with yourself, because it's hard. It's very hard. Even when there is more support out in the world for people going through that process now than there was 10 years ago, it's a hard process, and just expect it to be difficult. And go let your body and your brain kind of work out the pace, and, you know, don't push yourself too hard, or like I said, you'll blow a gasket and you'll be sorry.
And so the disclosure, that's a theme that I really, really want to support, and that's part of why I have this show. How would you see that adjustment period? Something that I imagine is something like, maybe first we see these beings on television or something like that, or in pictures. Then as a group, we meet with them so that we are not alone with them. I don't know. What do you think?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because I know that the likelihood is that we're not going to get the truth. You know what I'm saying? We're going to get a version of the truth on, you know, the new, you know, capital D day, disclosure day, whenever that happens. I seriously doubt that whoever makes the announcement, however it comes to the public's attention, that it's going to be everything, all of it, all the information, all the everything that we know that's true without holding anything back. I seriously doubt that's going to happen. What's more than likely is you're going to get a package of information that is what they think people can understand and digest at first. You know, and again, I think that just goes to too much information all at once makes people's brains explode. So, you know, giving them a little bit of information at once and a little bit of to digest at a time, that makes perfectly good sense to me. I'm not against that. It starts the conversation and it breaks what we, you know, the glass ceiling that there's all kinds of experts who can then start to talk about it. And as someone who observes the media a lot, I watch a lot of the news because I feel like, for me, I'm not suggesting everybody do this because sometimes it's difficult to watch the news all day long, that getting the raw in the moment as it's happening, as you're getting the actual words that people saying in the moment, not getting the edited version at 6 o'clock, you get, a clear picture of what people are saying and what their agendas are and what their goals are and what sort of policy things are happening on a political level, which I think is still important. But it's easy from watching that to see how we present information to the public, how we expect the public to absorb and process information, and how the sources of information have accommodated themselves in that relationship over the number of years, so that when that happens, there will be a process for it. There will be, here are the certain experts that are going to do the television news circuit, and then another series of experts, you know, will be wanted to brought into the circuit. And so certain people who have been talking about this for years to smaller, you know, fringe audiences will now be, you know, on the daily news shows.
Like you, for example, right?
Yeah, I mean, probably. So, you know, there's, at some point, those of us who are, you know, sort of doing, you know, JV league interviews are all of a sudden going to do varsity league interviews, and it's going to be a whole nother process. We're going to have an opportunity to talk about that message to a larger audience. But there's going to be an effort to still try and guide that process. And I can't, and I'm sure even as someone who's going to participate in that process, that I will fight for and resist certain things and want to go, you know, no, we really need to do this and talk about this. And but at the same time, I have to admit there are going to be certain situations where even I'll have to concede, well, all right, this is probably the best thing to do for now, because this is what's going to work. Because I know that as we move through that process, it's going to be this very sort of what we do each step as we see how we adapt to each step and what has to happen next. So what we think is going to happen is that we're very likely to see this transition soon, because we think that it makes the most tactical sense to do it in a presidential handoff, that it makes more sense for the person going out to say, there's aliens, I'm out of here, and then let the person come in go, oh, I'm totally shocked as you, I had no idea, and but I'm being briefed, and I will, we'll deal with this together. Then the person who's in office, If all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, we know, and I'm going to be the one here to help you with it, the public doesn't like that. We don't want the person who's sort of responsible for it to be the person to fix the problem. When there's someone to blame, or some, even if it's not your fault, it's just happened on your watch, that person's going to have to go out so that the incoming person can be all brand new with it. No, I'm shocked, and let's deal with this, and can sort of guide the process in a more of a clean slate kind of a way. So we think that that makes sense. We think the timing of everything happening, you know, we just feel that the delays are becoming so costly, not just to like the population or the people's cost, but it's becoming costly to people in government, people in the military, people in the intelligence community, business people. There are other people who are starting to see the loss of productivity, the loss of profits, the loss of public interest, the loss of technology. They're starting to understand that this is no longer about, we have to keep this quiet so we can continue to run the world. It's more about, hey, wait a minute, we're losing out on a whole bunch of opportunity here every day that we don't get this done. Yeah. So more and more people are realizing, like I said, business people, industrial people, military people, that to be productive in their jobs and just in how everything wants to work, that this is going to have to end. The secrecy on disclosure is going to have to end, because everybody's productivity wants to go forward. And the only way that's going to happen is when we end the blockade on conversation about it. But there's still some people that are not going to get, you know, airtime, that are still going to be sort of ostracized and marginalized, and there's still going to be arguments and infighting. But we're going to get past the point of the debate between the side that says, yes, there's aliens, no, there isn't, yes, there is, no, there isn't. We'll get past that, and we'll just settle that argument, and then we can move on in the process and just stop debating whether there are or there aren't, and we can just debate what to do about it and how we're going to deal with it instead of having the most ridiculous debate in the world on whether or not we have been or being visited by extraterrestrials when the mountain of evidence to that is so overwhelming that any single human being who says, well, there just isn't any good evidence on that. You clearly haven't looked at the evidence if you say there isn't any good evidence, because there's a mountain of it, so much of a mountain of it that exopolitical researchers in the last 20 years have now specialized. You know, in the 60s and 70s, you know, people really like covered all the topics for the most part. And you had, you know, maybe people like Hopkins and Jacobs who were really focusing on abductions. But, you know, exopolitics is a field that's really gotten specialized over the last 10 or 15 years because it's such a broad field. One person just can't cover everything. I mean, you can cover exopolitical history. You can cover modern events. You can cover secret space program. You can cover extraterrestrial alliances. You can cover abductions. All these areas that are such vast areas of knowledge in and of themselves that people can specialize in those areas and write volumes of books on them, and they are now comprising a library of information on what we know. So to say, oh, there's no good evidence, you're a moron if you say that. You haven't looked at it, because there's tons of evidence. So just getting past the conversation where we're no longer having that dumb debate and we're just having what can be a smarter conversation. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. It's not going to be the truth out the gate. It's going to be some of the truth out the gate, and we're still going to have to like work on guiding the process, guiding information, enlightening people in the process. Job's not going to be over just because we get to disclosure day. It's just going to make the audience bigger.
Right. And I imagine that also you have given authority to share all of this because you are part of the process of putting the word out, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole sort of the United States Marine Corps Special Section Special Code of Conduct outlines very specifically the duties and responsibilities of United States Marine Corps Special Section officers. And there are some very specific clauses on our obligation to act in our best moral obligated sense to restore executive, legislative, and constitutional authority over programs which are no longer observing that. So President Eisenhower knew that was going to happen. He wanted that written into the code so that years later, you know, we would have legally codified into law our rights and responsibilities to do that. So I don't harp on it, but I try to clarify when people refer to me as a whistleblower, I'm not actually a whistleblower, because whistleblowers don't necessarily have authority of their command. And sometimes it's unofficial, you know, their command goes, get out there and blow the whistle. You know, they're not like officially giving them sanction, but they are kind of like, go ahead, blow the whistle. We won't have you killed.
I don't want to have the noise of the neighbor.
Oh, no worries. So whistleblowers technically are blowing the whistle on something that, you know, is happening at a level that they feel like is breaking the law, and they're telling the whistle. My superiors and the code of law that we're obeying is actually very specific about what I'm doing. So I'm technically not whistleblowing. I'm technically acting under the authority of my superiors and under the authority of the United States Marine Corps Special Section Code when I speak publicly. So it's a slight difference, but you know, it does mean that I have all kinds of backing and authority and people behind me who have given me the nod to do this that other people don't have. So I feel lucky, and I, to be honest, I'm humbled that my superiors have this much faith in me and they have this much trust in me to be able to do this. So I really just, you know, try not to screw up and mess it up. And
wonderful. I'm sure you're perfect for this job. So. And is there someone that knows the whole picture? Because it seems that everything is compartmentalized. Is there someone that really knows everything that is happening that can put everything together?
I doubt it. I get such regular briefings now with my brigadier general, and I end up having regular conversations with intelligence officers and the command staff. And what I find in just asking questions about the things that are important for me to understand and important for me to ask questions about and deal with is that the vast array of information that we have about all the different groups, all the different consortiums, extraterrestrial groups and consortiums and beings that are all interacting, it's so complicated and it's so changing at every minute that we're trying to keep our intelligence apparatus updated on a daily basis so we know what's going on. But the truth is, things are changing so quickly that even when you have a top drawer, up-to-date, psionically staffed investigation intelligence team, you still can't keep up with everything all the time. And so I don't think there is a single person that could tell you, I know the whole big picture. I think there are those of us who understand it better than others because we understand some aspects of the big picture that people don't. But even as I find in the daily process, there's so many different things going on that everybody's really trying to focus on what they can focus on in their day. I mean, even people in the covert military space program got to go to bed at night, got to get up and got to clock in and do their job for so many hours in a day and then go home again. So they got so many hours in a day that they can do stuff. They got an inbox and an outbox like everybody else, stuff that's coming into their desk, stuff that's got to go out. And so everybody's processing the information at the rate that they can, trying to focus on the things that they can in really what is a wartime situation where certain things are taking priority because they're just way more important to the long-term goal than other things. And that just makes it very difficult to do anything other than do your job and try and get the best up-to-date information that you can on the stuff that you're supposed to know and try and communicate that with the people you're supposed to communicate with so people have intelligent information, you know, sort of definable packets of intelligent information that they can use in the field. And it's just such a complicated process that I don't think there's a single person that understands it all. In fact, I refer to it as the grand cluster fudge theory when you're really talking about how it all comes together, because it's just a grand cluster fudge, only it's not fudge, of everyone coming together and chaotically interacting with all these different departments, all these different programs who don't answer to each other, who aren't under a single umbrella of authority or regulation, and they all have different agendas with different extraterrestrial groups who are all doing something, some of them cooperating, some of them absolutely morally, ethically, militarily opposed to one another, shoot at each other in the sky, shoot at each other on the ground. So it's really complicated. I don't think there's a single person who could say, I understand it all. I seriously doubt there's a single person who could understand it all, given the complexity that it has arisen to.
So not even the people on top that is creating all of these projects?
No, I think that they're trying to keep control and understand everything that's happening in such a way that they can still only focus on what's right around them and what people are telling them. They're still basing a lot of their information on the intelligence they're getting. And we know that not everybody tells the truth, that some people give an intelligence report to someone because it serves an agenda. So some people who are at the top, who are supposedly receiving all of this intelligence information that they can act upon, in some cases aren't even receiving accurate information because they don't have control of the process underneath them. So they're getting faulty information to guide them in incorrect and different directions, not to mention that you have people who, if they met in a dark alley, they'd stab each other to death, who have to sit at the same table and sort of sort this stuff out. But really, they are so diametrically opposed to one another and they hate each other so badly that, you know, they'd slit each other's throats if they had the chance. So it's very complicated, and it's absolutely having a warlike situation with people who are at war with each other, who also have to sit down at the same table with each other and talk about management issues over something that has become so massive that nobody really has control of it anymore. That's why the fleet, the larger Solar Warden Radiant Guardian fleet, has had to step in and sort of try and create some regulation and create some stability and say, no, you're going to have compliance with these treaties. No, you're not going to get to break that law anymore, because it's just become a chaotic situation that nobody's in control of anymore.
Wow. And about the history of exopolitics in the 20th century, what would you share about that? It's a big theme.
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating subject with as much that has happened, but I think it's pretty straightforward that, you know, we had a In mid 20th century, we had a German industrial machine that was becoming very advanced very, very quickly and was receiving extraterrestrial guidance on how to build aircraft, engines, weaponry, rockets. And it took a few years for them to start really developing and building that technology. But they got the head start on extraterrestrial technological development, but everybody in the whole world. And so their military machine was able to sort of quickly rise to a state of prominence and sort of, you know, run across Europe. And if, you know, they had really been able to do it in the period of time that they had to do it and that their industrial base could have supported, which was really about 5 years. And they kind of learned this from World War One, that the German industrial base in size could maintain a military conflict for about 5 years before it would sort of reach that point where it couldn't grow as fast as it would have to produce. And so basically, whether they really followed this plan or not, I'm not sure. I think that's why they were trying sort of the blitzkrieg and so forth to sort of make it happen quickly, because they knew they really only had about 5 years to like win the war, or, you know, they wouldn't be able to sort of sustain it. And the United States and the Soviet Union were able to sort of, with their massive mining resources in sort of being able to iron and copper and metals, were able to create a manufacturing base that could support a military effort for a lot longer. In fact, we, you know, kept that going into the Cold War for decades. So the German machine had the technology, it didn't have the time. And so when the tide turned and we started getting our own advanced extraterrestrial technology to deal with that, it became a tide turning situation. But they took what they had, which were these Habano class extraterrestrial vehicles, and the Vril 1 and the Vril 2 class. We don't know whether they actually ever built a Vril 3, but we've seen blueprints of the sort of larger vehicle. And so they were definitely took what they had, which was not enough to make a fighting air force out of, but was enough to put their highest, most, you know, prized individuals and people on and leave and get out of Germany. And we know from Operation High Jump and the Admiral Byrd mission down to Antarctica and all of these other reports and the documentary film that the Russians did on the Antarctic expedition, the Nazis were sort of working on this Antarctic base that they had used their U-boats, their submarines, to come underneath the ice and sort of find these hollowed out ice quays and started building underneath the ice, which is really the only place you could do it. And to be fair, getting out of the air and the wind and the cold on the surface, it really would not be that hard to build an industrial center under that ice. I mean, you're talking about, you know, ice in some cases that was, you know, several hundred meters thick, in some cases, you know, 1,000 feet high or more. I mean, really thick ice that you could build a city under pretty much. Mm-hmm. And you could build machines and generators and trains and that they, we have, the Russians have, the paperwork from the manifest, the shipping manifest, that there were trains and train tracks and engines and steam engines and diesel engines and all these other parts that they were sending over to build this citadel. You have a statement from the German Chancellor of the Navy, which said, "We have built a fine citadel in Antarctica for the Führer," which is not a vague statement at all. A citadel is defined as a militarized city. There's only one Antarctica, so saying you built a citadel in Antarctica is really specific. Saying that you built it for the Führer is also really specific. So we have a ton of evidence that they went, as crazy as it may sound to some people, that the Nazis escaped Antarctica and continued to sort of try and push the Nazi machine from there and from South America, and that eventually, you know, they had to enter into sort of the global arena of states that are sort of let into the global consortium of covert military space programs. So the Nazi German machine eventually went to Antarctica, but eventually, like, the peace agreement globally was sort of established, and we sort of had to let them participate because they had the advanced technology and we couldn't really keep them from participating. And then that allowed for further sort of Nazi infiltration into the American military intelligence process and this sort of Cold War process to keep developing the technology, developing, knowing that if we didn't develop our own militarized space force, space army soon, that somebody would just run over us. You know, that if it wasn't the people we were already talking to, which we had our doubts about, someone else was going to come along and run over us like a steamroller. So the goal the entire time was just to develop that Cold War sort of secret space program technology so that eventually when we do talk to everyone about it, we won't go, yeah, there's aliens. Sorry, we can't protect you. We have no idea how to stop them from coming in and out. That way, when we get to the point of saying, no, there's aliens. Yeah, but we got a space army now and a space fleet. We're good. You guys are fine. Don't worry. Don't panic. So part of that sort of waiting until we had a military fighting force that we could say, no, we got you. We can still keep you safe. That was part of the process. You know, we can't talk about it until we can let everybody know that we've solved the problem and that people don't just start panicking about how you can't keep me and my children safe. And like, you know, for the most part, we can if we actually exercise the powers that we do to keep people out who shouldn't be in and to control sort of the people who are already here acting illegally. We can. So I think a lot of that process has just been getting to that point. And that's basically what the whole 20th century space program process was what happened with the Germans, then how we and the Soviets and everyone else got involved and just that continued process to develop those space programs until we had a fighting force that we could say, okay, we're self-determined now. We don't have to rely on some other extraterrestrial to tell us what our future is going to be. We can be self-determined to decide what it's going to be, and we have enough firepower to say, no, we're going to do it our way, and no, we're not going to let you tell us how to do it, and if we need to evict you from our solar system, we will. And that's really the only way you can do it. And I really have to agree with Eisenhower's early assessment when you know, the ETs that were like, no, get rid of your atomic bombs, get rid of your nuclear weapons, and we'll help you. And he was like, why would we want to get rid of the one thing that we might have to defend ourselves from a highly advanced, technologically invading space force just because you say that we should? I mean, I'm not saying that nuclear proliferation was a good idea. I'm just saying that not just handing over our nuclear weapons was probably a smart thing because that would have left us powerless in the face of defending against an invading force. So by saying, nah, we're not just going to hand over our weapons. We'd rather like be able to defend ourselves and watch our own backs. I think ultimately that was the smarter decision because otherwise we'd be in the position of someone else deciding that for us and us not having the free will to be self-determined as a species. And I think that human beings are smart enough that we can be self-determined and choose our own future without letting someone else tell us what to do. Because let's face it, at a certain point when you're growing up, you don't want your parents to tell you what to do anymore. You're like, I can do it. I can do it myself. I don't need you to tell me what to do, mom and dad. And we're the same way as a species. At some point, we just don't want the ETs, our extraterrestrial parents and mom and dads telling us what to do all the time. And at some point, we just like want to be able to figure it out and do it ourselves. And I think we can. I think we totally can. But to do that, you have to have a certain amount of safety, a certain amount of security, and you have to be able to defend yourself. So I'm not in favor of like killing everybody, but I am in favor of having, you know, a defense that you can protect yourself with.
So for example, that also reminds me the same situation as a human being, as a foreign being. You know, I don't like so much to have to always be in a system that has an authority outside of ourselves. And I was wondering if having developed the psionic abilities, it will help us being a little more empowered and a little more able to defend ourselves. So having that awareness about anything that can harm us.
Yeah, absolutely. No, in fact, when I really get talking about psionics, that's why we consider psionic development to be one of the most important things ever. Because essentially the difference between being a psionically emergent culture, a psionically emergent civilization, and a psionic civilization is that level of psionic awareness and psionic ability. And what happens when you go from being a psionically emergent species to a psionic species is huge, because that level of development in our mental abilities changes society when everyone has just a minimal level of psionic ability. And I say like the main differences are imagine a world where nobody can tell a lie anymore and get away with it because everybody can tell when everybody's lying. Like, if you don't think that would change the world that we live in, then you haven't thought that much about the consequences of truth and lies, which are huge. And if we all of a sudden had a world where there was way more consequence for truth and there was way more consequence and accountability for lies, pretty soon, you know, that would it would really stop being a part of our culture. And I mean, like, in if we really became a psionic culture, in 10 years, we'd stop lying to each other because it just would stop working. You know, it would just stop being effective. And after long enough of it not being effective, people would just wouldn't do it anymore. So I think that some of the greatest threats from extraterrestrial species aren't just technological, but are psionic, are their abilities to cloud our minds, manipulate our minds, make us think or feel things that we don't necessarily want to think or feel. So having a self-determined psionic sort of bubble around your head or your body is absolutely part of that self-determination, that part of that sovereignty of not letting someone else, you know, decide your world for you. But we still all live in a collective planet where we all have to work together, cooperate, vote, participate for each other's well-being, and we're going to have agreements and disagreements about that. So, you know, just having a certain amount of self-sovereignty is important, but at some point we still have to come together and know how to make collective decisions about what's good for everybody. And that also is a lot easier to do when people are more psionic, because instead of having so many harsh judgments about people, you won't just hear what somebody's saying. You'll feel their thoughts and you'll feel their feelings about things, and it just makes people connect with communication more. And so, you know, the impact of the things that you do will also be stronger felt. When people have a stronger psionic sense, when you hurt somebody's feelings, you're going to feel that more. And you go, right. Oh, I was a jerk right there, wasn't I? That made them feel terrible. And so, but no sense of that outside of yourself is like, whatever, it's their problem. I can do what I want. And so the ways in which culture changes because the way our individual relationships would change with going from psionic emergence to psionic is huge. And it's one of the reasons why we think we just need to sort of get the skills and the development and the laws out there so people can start just kind of building that up over a period of time and getting to that point of where it's just a natural thing that we're doing, we're aware of, and goes from being a kooky, hokey, airy-fairy thing to just something that's science and fact, and this is how it works. Because changing that is how we evolve. We're not going to evolve because we build a better spaceship, or we build a teleporter, or we build a wormhole. We're going to evolve because we psionically develop and socially develop.
Exactly. Well, Randy, thank you so much. This is awesome. I love this conversation. And I have like another 2 hours of questions. But we will meet once again so we can complete all the questions that I have for you. And thank you so much for all the information that you are sharing with the world.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Okay, so this was AirSky People Radio and AirSky People TV with Randy Kramer, Captain K, and his website is, aircitizenconsulting.org.
Correct.
Okay, thank you so much once again, and thank you everybody for watching. Bye.
Okay, and now, as you know, this is a network. It's the Enlightenment Evolution Network. So I'm going to just share with you the different shows that we have. On Mondays at 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, we have Heart to Heart Talk Radio with Daniel Scranton. On Tuesday at 12 noon Pacific Time, we have Soulful Printer with Rachel Arkelaus and Megan Crandall-Meyer. On Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, we have the Enlightenment Evolution Hour with Rob Gaffier, the creator of the Enlightenment Evolution Network. On Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, we have Consciousness Evolution Hour with Philip Mulligan. On Fridays at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, Pierre's Experience with Talina Angel. On Saturdays, like today, at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, is AirSky People Radio with yours truly, Victoria Vives-Wong. On Saturday at 9 p.m. Pacific Time, Disclosure Now. On Sundays at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, About Oneness with Karen Newman. And finally, Sunday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, we will have very soon the Resonance Intention with Saul and Neil Gaur.
Okay, bye for now.
You are listening to the Enlightenment Evolution Network. Welcome to Earth Sky People Radio. Living in harmony with Mother Earth and awakening to an intergalactic society. With your host, Victoria Vives, founder of Reiki Wellbeing and co-founder of the Earth Sky People Movement.